I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Good morning. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, here. And over there is Patrick Martins, also known as...
Well, I have invented myself a new tagline.
Yeah.
Atticus meets Attica.
I like that.
It's Atticus Finch and Attica the prison.
But
we'll explain. We'll unpack
we'll
that more in future shows.
Some other time. But yeah. But anyway, Patrick Martins, Katie Kiefer here. We have a great show lined up. But right now, we're about to read a tribute to Ig Vella, who
what
is
a
one
great
of
guy.
The early proponents of sustainable agriculture and a cheesemaker who won many, many awards in his lifetime. Ig was best known in recent years as the man responsible for some of the best dry jack anywhere. Vella cheese, started by his father Tom, was a regular winner of many national awards during Ig's tenure, and the special select dry jack made by Vella, many awards won by him. He was honored in 2006 by the first ever Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Cheese Society. He was also a respected community leader, which is kind of the most important part of his legacy. He served on the Sonoma County Board of Supervisors from 1964 to 75, and then became the manager of the Sonoma County Fair. Later, he was a member of the Sonoma Valley Citizens Advisory Commission from its inception, and following his 12 years of service on the Sonoma Planning Commission. It was his many years of community service that earned him the honor in 2006 of being the only Sonoman to have a bridge named after him.
The only living Sonoman.
Yeah, right. The Ig Vella Bridge, spanning Sonoma Creek at Riverside Drive and West Napa Street, will forever be a solid monument to one of Sonoma Valley's most solid and hardworking citizens. Patrick, I know you knew Ig. Why don't you give us a few of your personal reminiscences, and then we'll move on to our guest, Gary Edwards.
Well, you know, I'll let Gary do most of the talking, but, you know, Ig was a big guy. He was, you know, he's an old guy, a big guy. He had a unbelievably good sense of humor. And, you know, he really did things his own way. I mean, if you asked a stupid question, he'd be like,
kinda
that's
like
a stupid
you,
question. Yeah, I mean, I admire. There's a little Atticus and Attica in Ig. So anyway,
some Attica.
I've known Gary for years. He was one of the people who, I mean, I should say I first met Ig because the dry jack cheese was boarded onto Slow Food's Arc of Taste back when I worked for Slow Food. And if I recall correctly, dry jack was invented by Americans to be a substitute for Parmigiano Reggiano during World War II when
Amazing.
German submarine warfare kind of hindered the importation of that cheese. So Gary started the Slow Food Convivium in Sonoma and is an old friend of mine. And when he gave me the sad news, I said we have to have him on to mention a little something about Ig. So Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Patrick.
Hey, thanks so much for coming on.
Good morning to both of you.
Well, tell us a little bit about Ig. Now, you mentioned he's such a big part of the community. I mean, give us some of your experiences on why he was such an important person in your life.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm sitting in my backyard right now, and I look out my back patio, and I see Ig Vella's backyard.
Oh, and wow. So you were
so
close.
So that's how close we've been yeah. for the last 30 years.
Aw.
You know, Ig is, I'm reading in the paper today, the Sunday paper this morning, my 2.5-year-old daughter and my 4-month-old son and wife made breakfast for me this morning. And of course I opened the newspaper and there's Ig Vella again in the
awesome.
Paper.
As he should be.
And yeah, what made him so great? I mean, he was such a community leader. What made him talked about this force of nature, you know, that was Ig Vella?
Well, what he did is he took his with what he's done with food and with his father's business and his business, but he really concentrated on what he could do in a community from a public service point of view to preserve agriculture. And I don't know if he did it consciously, but I think towards the end he did. as he realized even more with the younger people coming up around him, that it was just so important to preserve agriculture. You have to build, and you have to progress still happens in building in communities and so on, but he always had an eye on how we could preserve agriculture and blend the two together.
Now, Villa Cheese was the first like solar-powered business in Sonoma, right? I mean, very forward-thinking.
Yes. Yeah, very, very leading edge, and also with water issues and things like that. He was always on the leading edge of conservation of water, obviously power with the solar. They used their own well on the property, which
they
has been around for many
years. They composted. They used their byproducts from cheese making to feed other dairy animals and stuff.
It's all very
forward-thinking, very cool stuff.
Yeah.
Especially coming from an old
school.
His
milk supply is only just a few miles away from the creamery, and then the whey goes back to the same dairy.
Right.
So it's very, very eco-conscious operation.
A nice closed loop. We like that.
Now, he was a tough cookie, too. I mean, not everyone could understand him because, you know, he kind of called it the way he saw it, you know, and I bet that probably rubbed some people the wrong way. But, I mean, I think most people loved him for it.
Absolutely. In fact, Father Mike at the services on Friday, he recognized that about there's probably some people sitting in the church that were with him or against him. But they were all there for him on Friday.
Yeah, everyone respected him no matter what.
And tell us about
he would get up in the middle of a meeting and start pounding the table and raise his voice. And
oh, Khrushchev.
He knew it was time to listen to him.
Yeah, that was his way of getting the floor. Now, tell us about his cheese. From the actual cheese standpoint, what did he do to carry on the legacy of his father, Tom? And you know, how did he maintain quality? How did he deal with his staff? I mean, talk about his, you know, he won the first ever Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Cheese Society. So tell us about him and cheese.
Well, one of the examples that he did is once he won the Best of Show at the American Cheese Society, he stopped entering, which I think is a very classy move, and I think that could go to everyone who wins at that show. Mm. But what he did was he always looked at the old recipes and the old things his father did, and he remembered back to the history of different things his father tried over the years, and he always tried to make an improvement, like the Asiago that he's been doing for years and the Toma that he's doing as well.
Wow.
He just went back and he reached back in his basically into his father's memory bank. His father lived to be 100 years old and had a lot of stories. I spent a lot of time with his father as well. And you just heard stories, and you heard all the techniques and so on. But what he did is he pushed that down to his cheesemakers and just conveyed that all the way down to his grandson, Gabriel, who is now working as a cheesemaker at the creamery.
Well, that was my question. Who's going to carry on? So it sounds like his grandson, Gabriel, is going to carry on Ig's torch?
Well, first, his daughter, Chicky, who's been running the business for the last couple of years, has been doing a fantastic job. She's going to continue, and the community of people that have been buying the cheese are in full support of her, and I'm going to go out there and just push it as well, because I believe in family business.
Now, what is your role with the Villa Cheese Company?
I'm Ig's next door neighbor and Ig's wife Sally. We walked past her house and spent a lot of time with her. But I just happen to love the family, and that's my goal. I you know, Patrick, I go out and sell cheese, millions of pounds of cheese.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You're being modest. You're very much involved with helping you know, grow American cheese culture and promote Northern California gastronomy. So, thank you so much for coming on. And you know, it's a sad day, and yet, you know, if anyone lives on, it's a guy like Ig. You know,
and his business clearly,
and his business for sure. So,
yeah.
Gary, well,
big cheese,
so. Yeah. We'll have you on again, but thank you so much for waking up early on a Sunday and talking with us about Ig.
All right, thanks for taking the time.
You betcha. Take care, Gary. Bye-bye.
Well, we'll
take a
break.
Let's take a 30-second break and come back with our first guest.
Mitchell Davis.
We're back. This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served, and by golly, there's a couple of tables empty here. It won't be long.
That's a first.
Yeah, it's definitely a good day to come down to Roberta's. It's Father's Day, and you know you ain't going to do anything better than this in terms of feeding Dad and making him happy. So our guest in studio today, I'm really excited to have him here, Mitchell Davis, who is the Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. He's also a cookbook author and food journalist with a PhD in food studies from New York University. Mitchell is a graduate of Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration. He majored in food and beverage management, spent 2 years cooking and eating in France and Italy before settling in New York City to write about food. He joined the staff of the James Beard Foundation in 1993. That's a nice long run there.
Yep.
And Davis's most recent cookbook, and remember he is a cookbook author, is Kitchen Sense, which came out from Clarkson Potter a few years back. He's also the author of two other cookbooks, Cook Something and The Mensch Chef. And he is the co-author with Michael Ginor of Foie Gras, A Passion, which was a Wiley book from 2000 and won the International Cookbook Review's Prix Lamazie for Best International Cookbook of the Year. Mitchell's articles about food, restaurants, and travel appear regularly, correct?
Yes, they do, but that's enough.
Okay, yeah, done. Too much. Done. Too much. I like to be thorough, Mitchell.
Well, I met him.
What do you mean? Come
he's
on.
He's a student of Barbara Kershenbach Imba, which is where I first met Mitchell.
Yes, we were classmates together.
Classmates.
No way. Yeah. How cool is
Mitchell
that?
Was like smartest guy in the class. He was the most well experienced. He knew everyone that we would go visit, all the field trips.
Wow.
BKG would look to him to like carry the class if she had to go to the bathroom or something.
How did that happen?
How did what happen?
How did you know everything before you went to school?
Because I've been at the Beard Foundation for 18 years.
Oh, so this is
I was still at the Beard Foundation then.
Graduate school.
I get it. Okay, sorry. Hey, I didn't go to college. What do you want? Come on.
You didn't miss anything.
I did fail to mention, however, that Mitchell blogs at cookandeatbetter.com. Yes. And that's a cool thing. I mean, Patrick and I argue a lot, Mitchell, about whether or not people need to learn how to cook. I am firmly in the camp of cooking for yourself is the best way to go. Patrick is firmly in the camp of convenience and ease.
No. I just think that if you're going to change society, I would have someone try to open fast food outlets that serve sustainable food rather than hope and pray that inner city people are going to learn how to cook all of a sudden. I think they need but I don't know that they will.
I don't think they're unrelated, I have to say, because I think that until you understand what goes into food, you don't really know why you care. Mm-hmm. At least that's what I believe.
That's an interesting point. Yeah. Anyway, but I want to just jump right into, you guys just did your first pop-up restaurant.
We did,
Let's talk about that for a second, because that was
cool.
Very radical for the JBF.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't, as far as I know, you've never done anything like
No, we haven't, except that we sort of put it in our mission because we've been doing a pop-up restaurant every day for almost 25 years. We invite chefs from somewhere in the world to come cook dinner at what is a residential brownstone on a little street in Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
It just so happens James Beard lived there. And then this
it's
idea...
Nice pad.
Yeah, it's a great pad. But what's funny is it's limited in a little way, partly because of its reputation and what happens there, but also because it's physically small and intimate and has a romantic vibe. So when one of our trustees who owns the building in which the Chelsea Market is located said, we have this amazing space for a short period of time. It was between tenants. Do you want to do something? We're just like, oh my God, do we ever? And then you learn that doing anything in this town is not easy, especially if it's temporary and especially if it's very public and involves food, makes it even harder. I mean,
absolutely.
It sort of makes sitting here in Roberta's more amazing to know what you have to go through to create a space like this just in the city.
Just for a short term, too.
And who do you pick to run a pop-up restaurant when in the way you're a representative of all chefs?
Well, you guys had different chefs, right?
Yeah, well, I was actually my project, honestly. I ran the thing.
How did you go about picking?
Well, you know, there's a million things. We had 10 weeks to pull it all together, and there's a million things that have to happen. So first, what was it going to look like? And we had an amazing architect, Jim Bieber, come do the work pro bono for us. But were we going to actually have it? We needed someone to do the licensing and permitting. And so we partnered with Great Performances, who've done this before, and it's an amazing group. They're caterers, but they do these sorts of events. They have a legal department and dealt with that. And then, you know, are we going to get any sponsors to help? We wanted to make it a very accessible in terms terms of price, but also we were having all day programming, educational stuff going on.
Yeah, you had a lot of chef demos and really
and
amazing
talks
chefs
and panels.
Yeah.
So then we needed some sponsors who were amazing. I mean, they came in. The whole idea of a pop-up is so cool right now, and I think partly the space and partly the Beard Foundation, and it all just fell into place. You know, the stars were aligned. We were given, we had to be out on May 14th, and then suddenly the next tenants weren't coming in, and we could extend it, and we thought, oh my God, now what? Because everything had fallen into place with the chefs. And oh, well, that was the other thing. Who's going to cook? And that's a big question for us. It's probably the most important question.
Yeah.
Sure.
And Laurent Gras, who is a great, one of the most talented chefs.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, he was
three
in
stars.
Chicago.
He was
yeah?
in Chicago at L2O. But he's received three Michelin stars four times in his life, three times in France, which is not saying nothing. And then in Chicago. And he was sort of in my pocket. He's a friend and he wasn't working at the moment. And he was just like, yeah, I'll do a week. And so with him in our camp, we got some great chefs to come in.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's a great idea. I mean, actually, for anybody who's trying to open a restaurant, like doing a little pop-up like that and publicizing it heavily, isn't that a swell idea?
It is. You do have to be careful. I mean, what happens when is a great pop-up that's happening in Soho, and the chef's name just flew out of my mind because we're on live radio here, but it'll come back to me. He's amazing. But they just had some liquor license issues because, you know, BYOB is not... it's not legal, even though it happens around town, and so you just have to be careful. And in the, you know, it was a huge success for us. We had so many people come in, young, old, new friends, old familiar faces.
Well, I checked
faces.
It out. It was fabulous food. I mean, really extraordinary.
We sold
good.
Out in 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes every week's events.
I'm not surprised.
Wow. Anyway.
Well, very interesting. Well, for our listeners out there who probably know about James Beard and the James Beard Foundation.
Sure.
Yeah,
well,
I'm
just saying
Mitchell
that.
To be able to describe
some probably
really
know he's
the...
a household word, but really give us a capsule of the mission of the James Beard Foundation. Then we're going to follow up that with some questions about James Beard himself and how he is still current in American gastronomy and this and that. So.
Absolutely. Well, our official mission, the thing that we, you know, is our charter is to celebrate, nurture, and preserve America's diverse culinary heritage and future. And it's broad, but also in our minds very focused because, you know, sitting here on a radio station talking about food in an amazing restaurant in Brooklyn is exactly the sort of thing that we think Beard laid the groundwork for in America. We take for granted that you can go to a market in Union Square, that you can, you know, mail order fine foods, that you can sort of live in this culture in New York, but even just across the country, and really celebrate and think about and enjoy food. And it's new to us. It wasn't always this way for a lot of reasons we could talk about another time. Anyway, so we express our mission in three main ways. The events that we do at the Beard House and events we do across the country where we invite chefs. And I mean, they seem like a dinner party and they kind of are a dinner party, but in our mind, and I feel very strongly, eating with people, but you can talk about food, you can study food, you can do all sorts of things, but eating with people around a table, enjoying sort of the real fruits of what we've got is as important a part of the food movement as anything. And the more time we do that, we think the better for everybody. So that's one thing. We give out awards in May, the first weekend of May.
Which are often described as the Academy Awards.
I was just
going to
say,
industry.
Yeah, these are not just any awards.
And we do a lot of them because we cover not just chefs and restaurants, although those are obviously really important, but also winemakers and lifetime achievement awards and food journalists. We feel really strongly, especially because of who Beard was and all that he did, that media is a huge part of a movement. And so like radio shows like this, radio broadcasts and magazines and journalism have their own set of awards. And then cookbooks also, and also restaurant design, the element, the environment that you're sitting in is a really important piece of it. So the awards are really our biggest profile thing. Then we have a scholarship program. We have since 1991 given out more than $3.5 million worth of scholarships and tuition waivers. And therefore, people, you know, young people going into food, career changers, professional chefs who get travel grants to go work on a farm. We administer something called the Jean-Louis Pelletin award, a grant, which is for working chefs to go learn about a product. And then there's the whole educational thing. We've started a food conference, which is an invitation-only conference conference for thought leaders of at a really high level. And it's not intended, it's not exclusive because we only want those people to deal, but it's exclusive because we're trying to bring together chefs and farmers and captains of industry and philanthropists and academics to align values. I mean, our core asset, our core constituency are the great chefs across the country. And we're trying to use that asset and their loyalty to us to help move some of these other bigger players into places we all want to be. I mean, of a piece with everything that you guys do, with what the administration is doing, but trying to sort of capitalize on the Beard brand and reputation to really force some people. And funnily enough, at this conference, we all sit around tables. They're in tables of four because right. of what I said earlier. We feel that's a really strong metaphor. And so we really are trying to bring all these different people to the table to help move everyone along a little faster.
Well, very, very fascinating. So now, what aspects of this that you do now, the expanded mission that is James Beard Foundation, what aspects did James himself bring to it? I know he was born in Portland, but did he spend his time? What were his projects?
Sure. I mean, I should say right off that this all happened posthumously. He died, and there was no provision for a foundation. He died in 1985, and it was really his students and friends and colleagues whom he had supported so much who decided to do something originally with the real estate that had been James Beard's house. That's why the house is so prominent in all that we do.
And it has no bedroom in it, right?
Well, he lived on the first two floors, and where his bed platform was, and we still have the mirrors on the ceiling to prove it, is now a table for six during the dinners that we do.
And
you
I've
know.
Been there to see it. I know it's true.
It's some people's favorite table. It's very intimate, so to speak.
Katie used the mirrors there. They yeah. came very
well, I always like to look at myself
while you're eating. Oh, yeah, very, very appealing all around. A tempopo aside. But he had nothing ostensibly to do with it, although obviously we draw on his legacy. And I think it's hard for people to remember. And one of the reasons I mentioned that not everyone knows who James Beard was is because he's a man who died 26 years ago now.
Before
food television, before all these sorts of things. But his legacy really was to think seriously about food and to take food as a serious cultural form in a way that I don't think many people, at least in America, it wasn't okay to do. As you mentioned, he was born in 1903 in Portland, Oregon, and he grew up surrounded by an incredible food culture that was there from the immigrant Chinese. His mother had a boarding house, and they had a Chinese chef that sort of instilled in him this passion and immense knowledge about Chinese cuisine.
Terroir there itself is unbelievable.
Absolutely. It's just, and he had an amazing, I think the most impressive thing about him was his memory for what he ate. And often you'll see some great food personalities that's the thing that distinguishes them, because many people eat a lot of great things, but many people think interesting things about food, but to just remember the details and the flavor memories of his childhood really permeate all of his work and all of his later writing. The beach in Gearhart, it's funny, we just got a note that there was a beach house in Gearhart, Oregon, where he spent all of his summers that's for sale right now. If anyone wants to start a little beard shack on the beach in Oregon.
A clam shack on the beach of Oregon. I like that.
Yeah, it's actually on the market. But he came to New York. He did not come to write about food, because that wasn't something anyone came to do anywhere. You know, people did write about food, but it was mostly society people, that some of the Lucius Beeb and all these great commentators on New York society or society anywhere, San Francisco also, where sort of food was a thing that happened because that's where people met. But he opened a catering company in 1939 with a friend.
Really? This is way early. We had Ariane Batterbury on yesterday. She was saying in the 40s, 50s, there were 2-3 famous restaurants. I mean, this was totally breaking new ground.
Absolutely.
It was a time of rationing food. You weren't even supposed to eat as much as you could.
Right. And in 1942 was when Gourmet Magazine was founded. He was one of the original contributors to Gourmet Magazine. But oddly, in the middle of a war where people around the world, you know, food has always been a fantasy object. I mean,
it's
today,
aspirational.
Too.
It's aspirational. Yeah.
When you look at all the food magazines, food is aspirational. And so even though Elizabeth David is the other great food writer who wrote when people couldn't really get their hands on anything in England,
and she was
writing
British,
about
right.
these writing about these famous or these fantastical meals in Provence and in Italy.
It's like the Tolkien of gastronomy, Lord of the Rings, for fantasy. And then there was the fantasy food, but
well, it reminds
both connected.
Me of especially of like Babette's Feast, where you have that movie that came out in the 80s or something, which is just when the food industry started to morph into what we know it as now, and suddenly the idea idea of having these, you know, multi-course meals with incredibly fabulous and exotic ingredients became really appealing and attractive to people. And right. I think that was part of the fuel that helped propel the
and
food.
And also, I think it's important they became accessible because, of course, people were eating fabulous food in, you know, Diamond Jim Brady's time and all that sort of stuff. But it was that was a pursuit of rich people who had means. And something changed. And I think Beard was really that's where his most important contribution is, because by treating food as a cultural form, it makes it possible for everyone to engage in that conversation.
So you're saying he democratized it.
Very much so. Did he have a mission?
He democratized haute cuisine.
Was he trying to promote American cuisine in America, or was he just a gastronome that happened to be born in America?
That's a great question. I think he was... I think it's that you can't separate them. He was very American. I mean, he was called already as early as 1957. The New York Times called him the Dean of American Cookery. So he was well established a long time ago.
And he had cookbooks by then.
Absolutely, many cookbooks. Yeah. The first book came out in 1940. It was called Hors d'oeuvres and Canapés out of his catering company. But one thing we don't always acknowledge, I think, is that he loved French food. I mean, he was a Francophile. He spent his summers with Simca Beck. Picnicking in France. And then with his Chinese food knowledge and Italian everything, he was just a lover of food. And the way he did it, I think, makes him as American as anything. He was just a larger-than-life character, literally at 6'4" and 300 and whatever pounds. And he sort of created this enthusiasm that I think still resonates. We're all operating in for food in general and for American food in specific.
Well, what a great lens into James Beard. We'll probably talk about him 100 more times on this network. Let's take a brief break, and then we'll come back with some more information about James Beard Society today.
From Mitchell Davis.
Thanks.
A public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Well, we are back with Mitchell Davis, and we're very excited. In honor of Mitchell, we saved one of our best kind of themes, guest ideas. We have four line cooks and sous chefs from Union Square Cafe to talk about what it's like to be a saute cook, a tournant, to run the kitchen, to run the cured meats program. So after this final segment...
So if you ever fantasized about working in a kitchen, you're going to get the lowdown.
Yeah.
From these four guys from Union Square Cafe, one of the greatest restaurants in New York City.
People today. Who you'll hear about probably in 5-10 years, but you won't hear about until then. But you'll hear about them on the Heritage Radio Network.
But right now we're with Mitchell Davis from the James Beard Foundation.
And I have a question. So you are the Oscars of food. So when I hear people talk about the Oscars, they often criticize them. Oh, well, you don't hear about the independent films. You know, it's a set group of people making these decisions. So you as a vice president and giving us a lens into James Beard, how do you attempt to tackle everything that's now happening in pop-up restaurants and independent chefs, ethnic cuisines, how do you attempt to truly be a national presence, even though you're based here in New York?
Well, the awards are, it's an excellent question. And earlier I said that I think that sometimes we forget that media is as much a part of a movement, especially of food, as anything else. And I think the Beard Awards are one of the places where that is really true, because the awards themselves are not administered. They're administered by the foundation, but we don't vote. Sometimes people think that, if you're good to me or I get a free dessert or something, you're going to get a Beard Award. I wish I had that power. It ain't true. No one in the organization who's on staff or anything votes, or on trustees. If you're a chef trustee, you're not allowed to be eligible for that period. So let's just get that out there. However, the way the world works is that the chefs that sort of rise up through the through the media, but also through people's sort of collective consciousness, are often the ones you see nominated for these awards. The awards are done in three stages. So there's an open call on our website. It happens mid-October, usually October 15th, unless that's a weekend. And anyone in the country can nominate anyone and vote on anyone. And we have, I think last year we had 14,000 people suggest chefs. So, wow. So and it grows exponentially every year because of the internet and because of people's interest in food and chefs. And we love that, because what that does is it shows us restaurants we may never have heard of that are not in the media, places that just percolate up, you know, in Omaha, across the country. And I bet you if we had an internet 25 years ago when we were founded, it wouldn't have been that way, because those restaurants were not there. I mean, it's one of the things that's great, is that there are people doing really interesting, serious, local, but also global, whatever food, all over the country. So that happens in October. Then the top 20 or 30 in each category become a ballot that goes to our judges. And the judges are journalists across the country regionally, but also previous winners. It's over 450 people who see that first ballot.
So it's truly a democratic process.
It is. Not unlike the Academy for the Academy Awards. It isn't. There's not a team of four people whose taste go out and eat in every restaurant and determine that this is the best and this isn't. It's just not. It's not practical in the country, and it's not what our awards is. You follow a great critic or John Mariani's whoever you want for that sort of thing. And in that first round, one of the things that had changed a few years ago, the list of 20 to 30 in each category was leaked. I mean, here's one of the benefits of the internet. It was going to be leaked, and to preempt that, we decided to release it, even though we didn't know what to call those people because they are not official yet. It's just come from this open call. But we used the term semifinalists, and we were a little nervous about what that would mean for the nominees and all that sort of stuff. But basically what it showed is that there are 30 restaurants in each region, in each category, whatever, that have come to the attention of the entire country's food intelligentsia, or whatever you want to call them. And it was tremendous for us. I mean, actually, this year, the release of the semifinalists crashed our servers. We were down for a day, everything locked down, because the excitement and enthusiasm for those people, those restaurants that made it to the short list, so to speak, is just incredible. So after that, the judges vote, and they narrow it down to five in each category. And that's when you start to see the familiar names, mostly, because the reality is that the restaurants people have been to, the places they know, the things that they think are worthy, are not, unfortunately, all 30 deep. But that doesn't mean that now that they're in the public sphere, so to speak, that those don't have a chance to come up. So I mean, I've been really, after 18 years of the foundation, I've loved how the whole process has evolved, because you start to see some places like a little Thai restaurant in Las Vegas be nominated and then win. Or you start to see, you know, in the best new restaurant category, you start to see places that have $10 million, $15 million budgets, and places that are independent little things, Teresi, Italian specialties. Sure. I don't think they had $500,000 budget in that place, percolate up. And to me, that's a really exciting snapshot. So in some categories, I feel like we are leading trends, but in mostly we're reflecting them. And because of the internet, and because of the participation, the democratization, the difference between those two periods is much shorter, and I think that they really reflect what's going on.
Well, tell us a little bit about your demographic of who your members are, like who are populating all these restaurants, and also tell us also a little bit about the demographic of your board. I know Dorothy Cahn Hamilton was there for a bit, and just tell us about the outside and the inside of James Beard.
Sure. Well, we have 4,000 members, and those are people who write a check to join, to affiliate themselves with the Beard Foundation.
And how much is a membership?
They start at $29, which is a national membership, and that gets you access to various things, and they go up to, you know, very high net wealth individual types. Mm-hmm. And membership, I mean, if you come to the Beard House a lot for dinners or for our various things, membership gets you a discount at those events mostly. But if you're not coming to expensive dinners, and they are expensive, membership really is supporting all these other things that we do. But, I mean, again, the world has changed and social media has changed things. And although we have 4,000 of those members, shows. We have just over 100,000 Twitter followers. And for us, that's so exciting because those are people we can communicate what's going on with chefs, with education, with farmers, with all the sorts of things going on that we count as in the family now as members. I mean, we have 35,000 Facebook fans. We have 30,000 subscribers to our twice monthly.
God, we have like 30.
Yeah, that's really impressive. You are going to be tweeting this interview, right?
Please, retweet us.
We're doing that. Of course we will. No, and we'll send a link to it. And I mean, that's our mission to keep those things alive among those people.
Absolutely. Well, nobody's going to hear better. I mean, frankly, we're the only radio station that I know of, and I've worked in media for a long time, that has the depth and breadth of food coverage that we do here. I
mean, absolutely.
It is really quite remarkable. I had a few questions to ask you, sure. Mitchell. And they've all centered around the idea of hospitality because you have this degree from Cornell. I mean, that's what launched me onto this path. And I thought, like hospitality in a restaurant, I don't care how great your chef is. If you don't have a front of the house that can make it happen for you, your chef is going to go down in flames. So let's talk a little bit about, do you think restaurants have really sort of recognized that you can't just have a star chef in the kitchen and still have like snotty kids in the front? Or, is there more training? Is there more sort of acceptance of that concept?
It's such a great question, especially because you have the folks from Union Square, the cooks from Union Square coming on after me, and they've sort of defined, Danny Meyer has defined American hospitality in restaurants in a way. I mean, whether we're talking a Burger Shack or the fine restaurant like Union Square. And I think that that American hospitality, at least the goal, the friendliness, the openness, the democratization of the dining experience is one of the unique contributions America has made to the world, the entire world of restaurants. And you sort of see that, I think, in the recent review in the Times. Sam Sifton just famously took down a star from Masa, which is, arguably the greatest Japanese sushi, Japanese restaurant in the country. And part of why I think he did that was because it didn't conform to our idea of American hospitality, which is not the same as Japanese hospitality or French hospitality.
Yeah.
So I think it's...
What are the different? What are the nuances? I mean, I'm just interested generally.
Yeah, right.
Well, in that particular review, which, we're talking about a restaurant that costs $500 a person, so that already it's in a category that
excludes 90% of the
99.9% of all of us. Even rich people would balk at the idea.
Yeah, sure.
But what I think is fascinating is you're eating in French, Chinese, or Japanese restaurants, no matter what restaurant you're in. Those are the three styles of restaurant in the universe. Japanese is sort of this interaction with a chef at a bar, and they've just created it, and it's unique to them. French is you sit in a room, and there's a kitchen, and people bring you food. And Chinese has a bit of both of them, but much more banqueting thing. And those are the only styles of eating. And in the Japanese style of eating, really, historically, it isn't about the experience of the guest the way it is in America. In America, is the individual is important.
It's about the chef?
In this particular instance, it's about the sushi and the chef. And so the fact that they lost a star because they didn't treat him as well as he thought he should be treated, I'm not arguing against that. It's just not, wouldn't equate into the Japanese restaurant. And it's funny, there's a movie coming out that I'm sure you'll end up talking about called Jiro, Dreams of Sushi. And it's this amazing documentary that we're actually going to premiere at our conference in October of the greatest sushi chef living in Japan named Jiro in Tokyo. And I coincidentally have eaten there and didn't even know it at the time. And you would never, there's nothing to tell you you're in the restaurant of the greatest Japanese living sushi chef.
Except for his food.
Except for his sushi and his philosophy. And to me, it's this perfect, it's almost so authentic that it only got 3 stars in some ways. And I think that speaks to hospitality. And that's not to say that I don't think, the customer ought to feel special. But hospitality also is a two-way thing, and you have to give it based on how people are going to receive it and interact in it. And I think that's one of the things that Danny Meyer teaches his staff so well, is to read the guest. And
the French style.
In the French style, right. Because even though he runs American, he runs a few French restaurants also, it's that style of restaurant is a French restaurant, and we're sort of grateful for that experience.
Franny's is definitely the Japanese style. Like, you feel like you're entering into their world. It's interesting to hear it broken down into three styles around the world.
I love that you were able to, like, really identify those three styles of hospitality. That's a very interesting story. But what do you think are examples in the French model, for instance? That's what we're talking about, because that's what Americans most respond to, of course. What are the examples of the best way to make diners feel welcome without swarming all over them? Because we've all had that experience of going into a great restaurant and you just, there's just too much attention. And it's like, how do you strike that balance between, like, being attentive but also being kind of invisible?
I mean, I think you need a degree in psychology, for starters, because you really have to read people. And every table, if you apply hospitality robotically, you're going to piss off 50% of the people. You just are, because every table, every dining experience comes with a different set of stuff, which is, I think, also kind of uniquely American, because we don't understand it all. We're making it up as we go along. We had happened to have this celebratory dinner last night at Danielle, and to me, in the French style of the most attentive service you can have and be the least intrusive, they just master it. You watch in the dining room, you watch swarms of people surround a table to put, and they don't even notice. Like, you can see it from where you're sitting, but they don't know what's happening. So that's one level. But you really have to read. You know, you have to. I have all of my friends have been waiters at some point, and the best ones who got the highest tips knew when to not be present in the conversation and knew when to help it along to make themselves known.
I would say Balthazar is not underrated in terms of a restaurant that's everywhere and nowhere at the same time. They have this group of runners, I guess, water guys, something like that, that end up filling a very important niche. I always felt well-treated there for a busy place like
that. I agree. And I think you feel well-treated for such a trendy place, because you go expecting them to snub you, and they're so nice, even though they're so beautiful, or they're so, you know, their heels are so high, or whatever is happening in a way that I think...
Or their lunch, which is always... That carries its own baggage in the United States, too.
What about their French through England in Soho? Balthazar, my favorite thing about Balthazar is it's the best theme restaurant ever created, is what I think, because that kind of restaurant doesn't even exist in Paris anymore. The French love it, because it's like, we don't have any of these anymore.
Now, how do you train the people at James Beard? I mean, do you have lifelong waiters there for your dinners?
People stay a long time. I mean, one of the things is it's a set menu, and it's all the seating's done at events. So there's no remember what you ordered and run and get that for you. But that doesn't mean sort of what you deliver in terms of hospitality is any different. The other difference is and this is a conversation for another show, is our staff are our staff, and they receive benefits and wages, and they don't work for tips, and it leads to a different relationship with people, you know, and I could argue both sides of which of those produces better hospitality. Again, we have people who request waiters just because they come regularly to the house and they feel coddled in a certain way, and everyone wants to feel taken care of, and I think that's why you have to learn to read people, because you have to learn what to give them that will make them feel cared for, whether it's filling your water all the time, which it is sometimes, or if it's just recommending a wine that is good and only $50 and not $500. You know, there's lots of ways to show that, and I think that's more important. The feeling you create that people have been heard and cared for is more important than, unfortunately, the greatest food in the world or the best decor or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can deliver that, and you have a home run.
Yeah, because it's true. Nothing can wreck an experience in a dining room than
feeling abandoned,
Just feeling like, oh my God, somehow this person thinks they're better than I am, and I'm making mistakes all over the place. And I think intimidating diners is probably the cardinal
sin.
Or
not giving them a drink in the first 5 minutes that they're there.
Yeah, well,
5-7 minutes. Yeah. You need a drink.
For me, it's pretentious service is the hardest, and it comes regionally. Like, it's funny, you when you leave New York, and San Francisco, you forget that people don't eat out as much or aren't as comfortable. The diners aren't as comfortable in restaurants as they are elsewhere, and you can see it in the service, the way they tell you things and the way they have to.
Well, in Italy, no one goes out almost. So I mean,
and if you do, it's like you're at home anyway.
Yeah,
you're
in an osteria with a grandmother, you know,
and the kids playing, and the guy
cleaning her underarms with a napkin or something like that. I mean, Italy, osteria.
I didn't go to that one. That's what that flavor is. We can't get
it. It probably does that flavor.
Umami. So, umama.
Oh, mama. You you mentioned for future shows, we want to have you back, but I personally think Mitchell could have his own show here on Heritage Radio Network, and it would be okay. super, like a pop-up show. He could do it for 8 weeks,
sure.
and then...
Absolutely.
Now, do tell us, and of course, we hope you stay for the Union Square segment, but tell us the scholarship program. I mean, that's really probably more than anything else, training the next generation or giving opportunity to people to be the next generation of gastronomes, of chefs. So tell us a little bit about it, who you pick and what, how you give.
What's the criteria? Yeah.
Well, we actually, again, we use a third, to maintain objectivity, we use a third-party nonprofit organization called Scholarship America. So if you go to our website at jamesbeard.org, you click on scholarships, you'll see everything there is to know. But what's happening behind the scenes is this organization called Scholarship America is handling the application process, which for the most part is standardized, but certain scholarships that require you to do things or if they're grant travel grants sometimes are a little more involved. And we have... It's funny because one of the hardest things in all scholarships, not just food, is finding the candidates. It's not so much finding the money in the scholarships because some of them, you know, if they're regional or they're to a particular school, you have to get the best candidates in the area. And we're not in the business of handing out money just because someone wants to go. We really want to identify best, and that's hard enough in itself, best and most needy, most in need of the experience.
Sure.
And in some ways, we're trying to rethink it. So a lot of our scholarships go directly as checks to the institutions, the cooking schools or to the other things. But one of my personal projects, and I'm gaining momentum, is to try to find a way to support people who want to be chefs, not just by paying for their tuition, which is obviously important because it can cost a fortune, but giving them money to have experiences that really help flesh out their whole food view. So whether it's money to be able to afford to spend a month on a farm or to, I think, to be able to eat in Japan and France and whatever, which is not anything you can do as a student or even on a chef budget, mm-hmm. to me, those are the sort of experiences that really enlighten someone.
I think, in a way, those are almost more important than getting you a scholarship to CIA.
Yeah.
Coming from someone who didn't go to college, I can see
well,
why
you think. I'm telling you, kidding. The reason I didn't go to college is because hands-on was far more valuable to me as experience in education.
Katie was a butcher for a few years, a Broadway butcher.
So,
I was a butcher in high school. Actually, I worked in a butcher shop in high school.
Cool.
I TA'd the meats class at Cornell.
Well, I still love the meat industry because I work with Patrick.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that giving people those experiences,
you know,
actually
we take them for granted.
Really, really cool.
And there's a big class differentiation in the kitchen between who's in the dining room and who's in the kitchen that I think is still one of the things we have to overcome as a food culture. Italy is the perfect place where everyone has access and the right to have great food in some way. And here, there's still a little bit of a divide. So I think anything we can do to help take cooks and people interested in food and give them these sort of mind-opening experiences. I mean, if you were to ask me, you know, what changed my attitude or my knowledge about food, it isn't necessarily the time I spend in kitchens, although that happened, but it's just seeing people engage with food in these different ways, I think, is really important.
It's like learning a language. It's also as part of the book that we're about to write on meat. It's, you know, this harks back to the guild and the apprentice and, you know, actually being in it. And, you know, it's a kind of
having
of a
those
cool,
seminal experiences that connect you to, you know, sort of the roots of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know I'm not supposed to talk about like my own experiences, but what, for instance,
why? Cause I yelled at you once.
Yeah. No, cause you yelled at me this morning, but
Katie's like, my dad.
Yeah.
Said,
my dad did this, but my, you know, I mean, I have an interesting background and I lived in France when I was 14 years old. And I, up until that time, I had been I'd lived on hamburgers and baked beans. I'm not kidding you.
Uh-huh.
Never touched a green vegetable if I could help it. And when I went to France and lived there, the true epiphany I had was not just how great the food was, especially meat, because that was my favorite thing, but cheese. And I became a cheeseaholic there, which I remain to this day. And it opened my eyes to, like, you know, things
to
don't
other
have
things,
to.
Not just
yeah,
to cheese, right,
exactly. Right. And that was my epiphany.
Those
and
are
my
the moments,
entrance
right.
into the food world. Had I not lived in France for that year, forget about it. I wouldn't have had that.
It's really.
We didn't have cheese here. We had Liederkranz and Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, of course. And you have cheese, and then you have cheese culture. You have one, like, you have to sort of see it. I taught for NYU for 8 years. I taught a course for 3 weeks in Italy, in Florence, and it was a graduate master's program for nutritionists and food study people. And the intent wasn't the intent was to give them a lot of information and do it in this sort of case study that is Italy, which is an incredible food culture. But the result was that being there and watching people interact so differently with food is what really educated them in those 3 weeks. Just 3 weeks is all it took. It can take a year and a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I was there for a year, epiphany, so I had to do it. But I mean, it
epiphany
really
only takes
took me
a second.
Yes.
One bite of moments, this right. Poitou vin, you know, or this cheese from Poitou, a goat cheese that was wrapped in grasses and made on a straw. And I was hooked. And that was it. And then it was me who chose the cheeses forever after. Mitchell, we have to wrap it up for this segment now.
We will
thank you so much. You will
talk
stay for
to you
the
about
next
booking
one, right?
you for your own pop-up okay. show here.
Yeah.
We'd
love
to do a
pop-up show.
I know we're not as big as your
You're going to stay for our Union
oh, no,
Square
but
voice,
this
right?
is going to go right to my bottom line, I'm sure.
Yeah.
yes, no, I'd love to hear. I'd love to meet the guys. I love cooks. I just think they're
yeah,
great.
Yeah, of course. What's
subculture of people.
Yeah, yeah,
thank
yeah.
you so much.
So we'll
what's your James Beard's website?
Jamesbeard.org. And on Twitter, we're at Beard Foundation.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Mitchell. We'll be back right back with the Union Square Boys. We're back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and over there is Patrick Martins, also known as Atticus.
Meets Attica.
Meets Attica.
Don't pretend you don't know. I know you never read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, yeah,
you should have
read that.
Well, this is a very exciting segment.
Fantastic.
I mean, we have, four people who, like I said earlier, you will probably be hearing about, definitely be hearing about in a few years. But right now, they are the famous underbelly pirates, you know, of the pirate ship of a great restaurant in America, in the world, Union Square Cafe. So we are joined by two sous chefs and two line cooks at Union Square Cafe, which is a Danny Meyer owned restaurant. Chef is Carmen Quagliata, and it's really unusual to have not one, not two, but actually four people who make a thing like that run. So,
and also, let's point out that you hardly ever hear from the guys who are actually, you know, I mean, we have the chefs on all the time, the head chef, but we don't often have the people.
And the
who
chefs
are
always
really
trying to get all the
happen.
Credit.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. But it's a team effort, and now we have the team. So.
Yeah, so we have with us the two sous chefs who Carmen referred to as badass pirates, even though they have all their eyes and all that. But Lou E. No, that's not Louie. That's Lou E. Perella. We have Robert Pugh. Those are the two sous chefs, and they're going to talk to us a little about running the kitchen and a cured meats program. We also have two line cooks, Joe Anthony, who is a tournant, which is kind of like a rover, and Amanda Wilson, who was the pasta chef, and Carmen said that he was very sad to lose you in that field, and now you're the sauté cook. So we're going to talk a little bit about all of that. So we'll start with you, and tell us who you are and what station do you run.
My name is Lou Perella. Lou E. Perella. The E stands for E, just E.
Easy E.
Easy E. Talk to my dad about that one. I'm one of the sous chefs. I'm actually the newest sous chef. I started officially in February.
And so your station is sous chef.
Sous chef, yeah. I'm sort of just overseeing the whole kitchen, standard operations throughout the day. And
that's called a tournant?
No, I'm the sous chef.
Basically,
okay. I'm the one telling the tournant and the sauté cook what to do throughout the day.
Okay. Who are you, and what station do you run?
I'm Amanda Wilson. I am on sauté at the moment. I was on pasta when I started at USC, and I've moved to sauté since then.
All right.
Hey, I'm Joe Anthony, and I am the tournant, and Amanda basically replaced me on sauté.
Okay, very, very interesting. Okay.
I'm Robert Pugh, and I'm a sous chef at Union Square Cafe. I'm positioned like Lou, I oversee kitchen duties and ordering and doing in charge of the cured meat program at USC.
So two sous, two line cooks. So what are the primary tools that you use in your station? Let's start with the two line cooks. What tools do you use in the sauté capacity?
Mostly sauté pans. I would say probably my most important is my fish spat. So sauté picks up, you know, our menu changes all the time, but right now I'm picking up a fish dish, chicken, pork. So, you know, just I'd say my Bain Marie with my saucing spoons and my fish batter, my go-to.
Interesting. And what tools do you use?
Oh, definitely my spoons. That would be number one for me. And then, I mean, in the type of kitchen that Union Square is, tongs are a big deal there.
You haven't really explained what a tournant is to people who don't know what that means.
Tournant is basically, it's a float. It's you're basically all over the kitchen, and wherever a line chef might need your help, you're there. You basically back them up.
Now, talking about tools, do you bring your own tools for these? I mean, I know, of course, every chef has a knife set, but for instance, if you're the sauté chef or if you're the tournant, do you have an extra set of tools, or does the restaurant provide those?
I would say it's half and half. I mean, as a chef, we all like our little tools and gadgets to bring in, but the restaurant itself does supply with a lot of the tools that you're going to need.
Okay. So now I'll ask that same question to you guys. What tools do you use?
For me, usually, for Rob, myself, we're doing a lot of the preparation for specials going into the night, so our knife is number one, always in our hand. Myself, I really like having a plastic bowl scraper. Basically because a lot of the chopping you do, it's easy to just scrape up right off the cutting board going into your wherever you need to go put there. Also, you need to clean out anything. It just gets right in there, molds to the bowls or any containers.
Mm-hmm. And for you?
And for me, I would say a lot of my small scissors along with a rubber spat just for – I'm very anal when it comes to people not scraping out soups or some things along those lines. But also as a cook, I would say my own tools, I would always like to have everything of my own in the way of having it be mine or my own responsibility and never relying on other people for that. So mm-hmm. Kind of tongs, spoons, anything along those lines, I would be my own.
And you bought these when you were in just breaking in, or are you aspiring to buy newer ones, better ones? I mean, like, how do you choose?
Along the way, and just seeing what I think could use better, or if I see someone else using something that I think works better that I don't have, I would just go and get it myself in that way, as opposed to relying on the kitchen or something else that having it that way. So in that aspect of it, I would just take it out as it would go.
So now, next question for the four of you. We'll keep it here with you, Robert. Who do you report to in the hierarchy?
Essentially, it would be our executive sous chef, Chad, and Chef Carmen.
Okay, so then give us an example of when, you know, they might say something to you, like, how do you report to them? How do they command? I mean, how does this system work?
I mean, in the sense of things, like, Chef Carmen is, you know, he's the leader of it all. So, and then Chad, you know, is our executive sous chef. So when he's not there, when chef's not there, Chad is essentially what represents chef. And then as sous chefs also, we represent what chef wants and have to carry out his will in a way. And but with that, we also get leeway to express our own feelings on how we feel about what certain food aspects are. And so when we present new ideas or have an opinion on something, we go to Chad or would it be chef and say, hey, I have an idea on this, or hey, taste this, does this work for you? Mm-hmm. Is this okay to implement in this way? And so therefore they, you know, have the final say in what goes on, but it's more of a collaboration in the same way where, you know, you present it that way and you create a flavor or create a dish, and mm-hmm. it's not so much of like, hey, this is me, you, or it's more of a collaboration that way. So, but they have the final say in the way of how, you know, if it's going to go on the menu or try it out, and then we'll see how it goes from there.
Okay.
And making adjustments based on that.
Now, you, Louis, who do you report to in the kitchen?
I have the same supervisors there. Chef Carmen, obviously, the head, and then our executive sous chef, Chad, would be the other sort of next step. I also, being sort of only being a sous chef for a few months, I, even though it's like we are on the same page or the same level, Chef Anthony and Chef Rob, I still go to them and I still like to follow up with them on a lot of things that I'm still learning, and just to ensure that I'm doing them properly. And you know, I'd say I use them as a really big resource and make sure that I'm taking the next steps and sort of coming up to the next level.
Fantastic. How about you? Tell us about the life of a line cook in the hierarchy.
I guess, a step level down from the sous chef. So we report to any sous chef. There are four of them, like Chad being the exec, and then obviously Carmen is our head chef. So, you know, we're right there below them, and we want to make sure that they, you know, everything we're doing, they're approving, and, you know, anything that they want us to tweak or change how we're performing, that's who we report to. Yeah.
Okay. And I have a question now, the next question, which I'll refer to you to start off. How much do you prepare in advance, and how much do you prepare kind of a la minute, like when an order comes in? Like how... you know, tell us about it, because you're there for many, many hours. Tell us how it plays out, like reacting to an order versus, preparing well in advance.
Well, of course, you want to make everything as fresh as possible. I mean, that, I think, is the background of Union Square. We have the Green Market right out back, and, you know, that's our foundation, is fresh food, great quality from the Green Market. So, of course, you want to, you know, cook it to the last possible minute when you can. As far as bulk goes, I think it all depends on the day, whether it's a Friday, Saturday compared to a Tuesday. You don't really want to end up with too much stuff at the end of the night, and it all just fluctuates in certain times, certain days, when you're going to get hit. We have the reservation seat, so, I mean, we can see when we're going to get hit at certain times.
Okay, so you prepare for that. And so how many hours before service do you actually arrive as a line cook to get your station ready?
Usually we arrive about 1:30.
Okay, so well before.
Yeah, pretty well before. And, you know, by the time we get in, there's already lunch service going on. So we, as line cooks or tournant, we have to coordinate with the people that are already there, the mm-hmm. people that are working the lunch crew as well.
Now, as a sous chef, do you what time do you have to report in, and what types of preparations are you making as, I guess, kind of roving people, like people who go from station to station? What time do you get in, and how do you prepare?
We have a little different schedule than the line cooks and our prep cooks and everybody. We have a morning sous chef who comes in with the morning cooks at 7 a.m. Basically, they look over everything from the night before, sort of see what we have left over in terms of protein or any other special mise en place, start making soups or any sauces or any specials for that time. And they sort of just get the kitchen rolling in the morning. We have another sous chef who comes in around 11 o'clock, right before service, to help just sort of get everything tied down for service, to start service, lunch service at 12, start the evening specials. And then our PM sous chef will come in around 1:30, and will help start prepping any of the final dishes for that night. As well as sort of getting the kitchen into dinner mode, making sure that our morning cooks are cleaning up and getting out, make sure the PM cooks come from their prep stations, set up their line, make sure everything's ready to go. So it's, you know, we have different steps that come in, and on the weekends, you know, we have a fourth that comes in sort of in the middle there too, just so we have all hands on deck ready for, you know, busy weekend night.
So a few more questions for the group, and then we'll open it up for the last few minutes. I'll start with you guys with the line cook. So you guys get totally slammed. Hundreds of people come in. You're not expecting a big tables of 6 and 8. How do you still maintain? How do you turn it up? How do you speed it up while still maintaining quality? I mean, pasta especially. I can imagine there's such a low margin of error with that. But how do you really keep quality while still trying to deal with hundreds of people within a 2-hour period?
Well, kind of what Joe said before, we have an idea as line cooks at the beginning of the night, which is like the back and the front are, coordinate a lot. They tell us we have an exact spread of at least reservations. So there's always like room for walk-ins and everything, but more or less we have an idea. So we know how much we need to prep and get ready. And then in those moments, we call them pushes, where we get slammed with tickets. And the great thing about USC is we do have a lot of hands on deck. Like someone like Joe Tournant will, as soon as you feel like your things are maybe a little bit slipping on your station because you have so much doing, like somebody jumps on to help you. So to help plate or to help that. So that's how we maintain quality.
Are you reluctant to ask for that?
Absolutely.
You feel, yeah,
like, yeah. Like it's kind of a pride thing with a line cook. Like I don't want somebody to come on, but you know that number one food is the guest. And if your food's starting to slip or your time, like our food's not coming up fast enough, and the expediter, the sous chef, will say, hey, this ticket's at 25 minutes. Like, we don't really want to go past a guest waiting a certain amount of time. So, okay, their food's not coming out fast enough. I'll say, hey, Joe, come help me plate.
Just to add on that real quickly. Yeah. At Union Square Cafe, our line consists of 3 people on a hot line, a grill cook, a saute cook, and a pasta cook. And then Garmage is one person on Garmage. So in aspects of, like, the volume, what we do, our hot line is only 3 people. So when she says it gets really busy and she may need a hand on that aspect, it's like you get overwhelmed with a whole lot of stuff. And it's like, I got to know how to mentally manage this also. It's a mental game as much as it is a physical game in that way.
Well, can you just break down the minutes? So someone comes in and orders. Can you tell us minutes by minutes, like how that gets divided up from a kitchen's perspective?
Say minutes and minutes and when the order comes in.
Yeah, order comes in, how long before they're supposed to receive their appetizer at their table?
Depending on how busy it is. In the beginning, when there's not, and obviously the dish that gets picked up, for a hot pasta or 3 hot pastas, we expect it to be on the table in no more than 10 to 12 minutes.
Wow.
And then from when those appetizers go out, when entrees, we expect to be at the table within 20 minutes after the appetizers had gone out.
20 minutes. And what if someone's a talker at the table, like Katie, for instance? Then, how does the waiter come back and communicate? Don't fire the main course.
The waiter
course.
Would have to come into the kitchen and ring in a hold ticket or tell you to hold it. Look, they're taking a little bit too long. But that's also an aspect of them reading the table and knowing that, hey, this is because they know that when we're going to fire, and if it's really busy, when we're going to fire, and if those things are working, they have to have the knowledge and the athleticism we use at USC a lot to say, hey, hold that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they can trickle down and cause a little riff, especially when we're super, super busy and, disrupt service in that way. If it's like, hey, stop doing this, or we have to avoid something in that way.
So, Joe, as someone who has to know when to be there and know when to not be there, something we were talking about earlier, tell us what is the most challenging aspect of your job?
Well, for me, I mean, I've always told Amanda, too, it's like, you're busy, don't be a hero. We kind of have a little joke about it, but I mean, essentially, I'm jumping on to when the busiest moments are. So, I mean, as soon as I get in there, I'm in the fire already. So, I mean, that's definitely my aspect.
Okay.
The first thing you do is, you get online and you have to kind of readjust everything and let everybody know what's going on, what they're doing, and, what tickets were fired on, and just kind of, like, organize for the first 2 minutes. And
how do you stay busy when it's not busy?
I mean, whether it's prepping for, a soup for the next day or, just helping out with random stuff. I mean, because we like to prep fresh as well. So we'll keep certain preps and pars going throughout the night.
What's your most challenging aspect, Amanda?
I think going back to what I was saying before, just making sure that we do get, it's not a, for how many covers we do a night, it's not a huge, there aren't a lot of hands on deck. So just making sure that I feel really confident about the food that I'm putting up. Like every plate should be, like whether we have 2 tickets on the board or 20, like I want all my food to go up the same exact way, like as perfect as it can be, and I'd say that's probably my most challenging aspect.
I can tell now why Carmen was so sad to lose you as the pasta guy. Like, he needed you to move somewhere else, but he was sad to lose you there. So tell us about you, Lou. What is your most challenging aspect as a sous?
I think it actually comes down to while I'm the expediter and sort of managing that time and trying to convey the importance of the time to not only the line, you know, informing them of where their times are, you know, say a ticket is approaching 20 minutes and I'm going to need that food. Also managing first courses going out because our pasta station is cooking first courses, mid courses, entrees, picking up soups, picking up sides. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they start to get making sure that they're, you know, keeping an eye on everything and making sure everything is just still flowing. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, it's a lot to, it's a real big mental task to really just control everything in the kitchen, at the same time answering questions from servers and you know, and sort of just preparing everybody for the next step. And so it's really the mental aspect is really what's the most exhausting at the moment.
Wait, I have a question. I want to backtrack a little bit before we go forward and talk about what you guys were talking about a little few minutes ago about when you develop dishes. And I want to hear about how much input do you get? How do you get trained on a dish? Mm-hmm. How does that whole process work? Like when Carmen comes up with something great or you come up with something great, how do you put that through the channels so that it ends up on the menu?
I mean, I can elaborate on a little bit more on that. Essentially, a lot of times with chef and or myself or any of the sous chefs come up with a dish, it usually starts off with an idea of like, hey, I want to use this product, or I found, especially it's such a green market driven restaurant 4 days a week. I saw this, you know, we all of a sudden have fava beans in the market. We should use these. So it becomes more of a dialogue in that way. And we have a general idea of what we want in the way of a dish. And then a lot, depending on what cook is picking it up or what other sous chefs are so is working with you on that. As it's usually like a day-long process in the way, once it comes time to pick it up, we figure out how we want to pick it up. If, you know, once we cook it and we taste it, it's not the right flavor we want, and making adjustments to that. So, in a way, it's a collaboration with the initial thought for whoever had it. Then chef will usually talk to one of us, and then the cook maybe picking it up. And then as we go through the day or through service, things may change the next day based on how to make that dish the way feasible for service and the best possible way we want to go about it. So it's very much a group discussion in that way.
Yeah, but how do you actually train, like, say you come up with a chef or Carmen does, and then you want to communicate to Amanda, say, that you're going to do this new sauté or when you were doing pasta, a new pasta. Like, how do you convey that recipe, and then how does Amanda convey it to whoever is helping her out?
I would say first and foremost with certain purees or certain, like, especially like custard-wise, it's a bread pudding or that. We do develop recipes for that in the way, and then we train them how to do it. So the first, I'd say like five times they do pick up that dish or they do make that part of a dish where a sous chef or chef is with them along the way to make sure that they get and understand the flavors we're trying to achieve and also understand the technique that needs to happen for whatever, for bringing out the best quality product, especially when and knowing what adjustments you can make in the busier service times when you need a whole lot of saute pans or a whole lot of different things at one moment and how you can achieve that same result.
Well, we have Carmen's going to stop buying from Heritage Foods if we keep you guys for too much longer, but I have two more questions that Katie and I came up with. What is the most important quality in your job and in a head chef? And I know Carmen's a good one, so it's safe to ask this question to you guys. But tell us about, if someone's a kid out there and they're like, hey, I might want to get into food, and they're going to have to go through the hierarchy that you guys are going, you know, starting at the bottom and going to the top. You know, what is the most important quality of being a good chef and, you know, in Carmen's position, being a head chef?
I would have to say consistency. And that it comes in terms of, when you create a dish, you want to create it the same exact way every time. When you manage people, you want to manage them the same way every time. And when you do something, like, you want everybody to understand that it needs to come out one specific way. No changes. Like, don't go rogue. Don't, you know, it's like we need to make sure that things are are a specific way. The chef wants it this way, it comes out that way. But
how do you do that? Because, I mean, the kitchens I've always heard about, I mean, especially high-end ones, can be, you know, I mean, in the French tradition, I mean, they used to, like, beat the sous chefs and stuff like that. So how do you stay consistent while still being in a hot bed of activity?
I mean, a lot of times it's, you know, reflecting on yourself and, you know, asking yourself that the same questions are, you know, am I treating Amanda the same way as I'm treating Joe, as I'm treating Robert, while I'm working with them, and making sure that, you know, you're checking yourself. And then with the actual food, it's tasting and talking to the cooks and talking to everybody and say, how did you prepare that? Or, you know, like any single salad that comes up when I'm expediting, I take a bite of it. I'll take a little piece off and I'll try it, just to ensure that we have the right balance of acid and oil and salt and any other garnish, because you don't want two people to get a salad at a table and one person to get a very acidic salad and one person to get a very oily salad. And when you find that that consistency isn't there, then obviously it's replate, redo it, and making sure, just checks and balances, really.
That's a good answer. Amanda?
Going in kind of like a different direction with what, as somebody who's, like, I've only been cooking for about 2.5 years, like two years or so. So for me right now, looking at superiors and where I want to work, is I'm kind of looking for somebody who motivates me, mm-hmm. Who's really passionate. I have a lot to learn about food. There's, you know, everybody has a lot to learn about food. It's insane how much you can learn about it. But so I think that's what I like about USC. Like, the menu's changing. We're using Green Market. Things are different. So it's not an easy job. You know, I get home at 12, 1 o'clock. I can't fall asleep till 4 because I'm so wound up from, you know, working on the line for 10, you know, 7, 8 hours. And so, like, going back to work and having bosses who are really passionate and helpful and teaching you things, that's kind mm-hmm. of what motivates me and gets me, like, excited about work every day.
Good answer.
I think it all circles back around to when I was growing up, what helped me was to understand a product or a technique is having my mentors tell me the reasoning behind it, the reasoning, the science behind everything. And that for me really helped with not just that particular moment, but it also helped me with other techniques that I would use for a certain preparation. And it's really just the understanding and, you know, having a chef there telling you, know, what's up and telling you why this is happening, what's going on, what's the transformation. And it all starts with a chef that's passionate first, mm-hmm. a chef that knows what he's doing and has great taste.
Who does crazy stuff like bring in half cows and all that.
Absolutely.
Now, was that you had to deal with that, that half cow you brought in?
I mean, I partially had to deal with that, but...
Okay. But you are a part of the Cured Meats program, yeah?
Yeah, essentially, I would say chef gave me the, you know, when I started a while ago, he's like, hey, you and I are going to do some salamis and stuff. And from that point on, I said, you know, it didn't make sense to me why we weren't doing it at Unionsburg Cafe. And it was like, hey, I'm just going to do this. Chef, is that cool? And he said, yeah. And so from that point on, I started it in the way of doing, you know, different salamis, copas, prosciuttos, different sausages and different things along those lines. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just want to use better, you know, instead of using certain pork products, you know, talking to you and on the phone constantly, like, why we have the certain pork butts and we enjoy using them. The flavor and the marbling all works in a certain way. So that's what came to me on that way of way of teaching me and just kind of like setting a guidestone, or I'd say like giving that little push to say, hey, you know, this is a little way you can go, and then work with that in your own mental way, and I'll help you guide you along the way. Mm-hmm. So something I, like Joe said, I agree within the chef, the asking why, reasons why. I remember as a young cook, I'd be taught something. I'd ask them, well, why is this better? Or, you know, what makes this way? And intuitiveness to constantly learn something new, mm-hmm. and have someone give it to you. Not give it to you, but, you know, get it from someone from your own efforts, not having to be handed to you.
So. Very, very interesting. So our final question, you guys have been absolutely great. I mean, what fantastic answers. What a fascinating lens. I've learned more about, you know, what a kitchen is. And I'm friends with tons of chefs in this interview. So our final question is, besides ousting Carmen and Danny Meyer, what are your goals? Just kidding. That was a joke. But, you know, where are we going to see you guys in 10 years? And I know that's an impossible question. And I know, obviously, your loyalties lie with Union Square Cafe right now and Danny Meyer's Empire, but like, why did you get into this industry? You know, from what you've learned at Union Square, and I know it changes probably day to day and week to week, but like right now, where would you predict we would see you in 10 years if you stayed in food? So I'll start with the two line cooks, and then we'll go to the two sous.
One sec. I've kind of had a dream since I was, you know, young. I've loved to own my own restaurant, so I guess hopefully in 10 years, like, that's what I'll be doing.
And what kind of food will we eat there?
That I don't know. That I'm still trying to kind of figure out. Right now, I think I'm in a great spot. About 5 years ago, I was living in Colorado. I was in college out there, undergrad, and I was working in front of... I started, actually, my food career in the front of the house, and I was working at a Marriott hotel. We had tons of regulars, and so I was talking to somebody on a regular basis about my, you know, food dreams and whatnot, and he came in, and he actually brought me Setting the Table, which is Danny Meyer's book, and he was like, you should read this. Hmm. And it's just kind of fun. Like, it's kind of... to look at myself, and back then, like 5 years ago, I was in, you know, Colorado with reading Danny Meyer's book, and now I'm at USC as a line cook, so I'm happy where I am now in 10 years. Like, if I'm owning a restaurant, then I'm doing pretty well, I guess.
Good for you. All right. Well, that's Joe.
Well, hopefully in 10 years, I'll be the chef at somebody else's restaurant, because I really don't want to deal with the financial side of that, but I mean, I think that's
everybody's
dream.
Because that is a big part of what a chef has to do, right?
Absolutely.
Is the Excel sheets and the P&Ls and all that.
Absolutely. But as far as 10 years from now, I think, you know, originally I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida, and I did move up here for, you know, to come work at the best, you know, city in the world, basically. So, I mean, it could go either way for me. I've really fallen in love with New York. I could stay up here, or, you know, I could take a piece of New York back with me down to West Palm Beach.
And what would you bring with you? Italian food, or?
I would say I'm pretty eclectic. I really would leave the menu open. I love cooking all types of cuisine.
When people say Italian food is just fresh ingredients anyway, so there's, you know, you could say French, you could say Italian, so it's all the same. So we'll ask you, Robert.
For me, I'd say my long-term goals is to be my own boss. I'd say that's the first, my original thought. Where I'd be in 10 years, I'd still, hopefully, cooking in some aspect of ways. I don't know if I'll be a chef yet, but I'd put it that way. But for food-wise, I definitely... when I was originally thought for food, it would be Italian. It's always been like my way I grew up, and it's always what I loved, especially pasta. But to quote a friend of mine, he said, I don't know, but he said, food of the sun. So that's the kind of food I would do.
Hmm.
Food of the sun, I like it.
Sun is very important for food. So good answer, and we will end with, with Lou E. Perella. Tell us about you in 10 years.
My family, my parents own a restaurant in Rhode Island, and that's sort of where I got my big start.
Katie's from Rhode Island.
Are you? What part?
Matunic.
Oh, I'm from Warren.
Oh, okay. I'm on the southern coast there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to Johnson Wales?
No, I went to the Culinary Institute of America.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting choice. We'll talk about that after the
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely.
Oh, by the way, before
there's a whole other side.
That's a great question. Did you guys all study at the big schools?
No.
Went to Florida Culinary Institute.
You went to Florida Culinary.
I went to Institute of Culinary Education in Chelsea. Yeah. Ice.
Okay.
I went to Culinary Institute of America.
Okay, interesting.
Rob and I met at the Culinary Institute of America.
Very nice, very nice. So sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. So my parents own a restaurant, and, you know, ever since I sort of left the nest, my dad's been trying to get me back. And I think after a good 10 years of experience, you know, like Joe said, working in the best restaurant city in the world, just getting experience, you know, working with food for the next 10 years, hopefully making my way back to, you know, to Rhode Island.
The great state of Little Rhodey. Well, dude, are you going to be working? Why don't you talk to Jimmy Bradley? He's a Rhode Islander. He's from Charleston.
Yeah.
All right. Come on. Easy now.
But
this has been what a fascinating, fascinating show.
You are such a buzzkill, man.
I'm sorry I waited to get buzzed till after the show. But just kidding. Anyway, this has been an absolutely fascinating, fascinating lens. I mean, we started with an obituary to Igvella. Then we had Mitchell Davis from James Beard Foundation, vice president. And now we had
the backbone of the Union Square Cafe.
The soul of American gastronomy. It's Absolutely. In the kitchens. And so thank you guys so much. And apologize to Carmen for making him have to run Union Square Cafe on Father's Day by himself.
Yeah, really. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. In the wake of the massive E. coli outbreak in Germany, which was finally traced to organic sprouts, the editors of Food Safety News published an editorial suggesting that all sprouts should come with a warning label. The CDC, or Center for Disease Control, is echoing that sentiment, saying sprouts are not healthy food for everyone. Children, the elderly, and persons whose immune systems are not functioning well should not eat raw sprouts, because current treatment of seeds and sprouts cannot get rid of all the bacteria present. Persons who are at high risk for complications from foodborne illness should probably not eat raw sprouts, according to an article in the current issue of Emerging Infectious Diseases, CDC's peer-reviewed journal, which tracks new and re-emerging infectious diseases worldwide. Although sprouts are often considered a health food, the warm, humid conditions needed for growing sprouts from seeds are also ideal for bacteria to flourish. Salmonella, E. coli, and other bacteria can grow to high levels without affecting the appearance of the sprouts. Researchers have treated both seeds and sprouts with heat or washed them in solutions of chlorine, yum, alcohol, and other chemicals. Some of these disinfectants reduced the levels of bacteria, but a potential hazard remained, especially for persons with weak immune systems. That would be the elderly, children, pregnant women, etc. High temperatures that would kill the bacteria on the seeds would also keep them from sprouting. So until an effective way is found to prevent illness from sprouts, they really should be eaten with caution, if at all. And by the way, it's National Sprout Month. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco host Unfiltered, Heritage Radio Network's very own wine program. Here's a small clip.
I will say that I tasted a lot of wines, and I went to Bollinger. Mm. And it was the special cuvée, which is, and I'll explain the difference between that and Roeder in a minute, but the special cuvée was the most three-dimensional wine that I'd had in my mouth up until that point, and it was actually pretty much one of the only ones of the day. Really spectacular, and it's made, I'll just say, in a different style from Roederer, because it is a certain portion of the blend every year, and their style is aged in barrels, and it gives it more of a toasty, fuller style. And it's really, anyway, it's a big champagne.
It's a masculine champagne.
Mm-hmm. It is. I tried to stay away from that, but it's true. I mean, James Bond, the whole thing. Yeah. But it's a big wine. It's a great food wine. But then,
want to hear more? We'll tune in every Tuesday at 4 p.m. live to Unfiltered, or check out the old episodes in our archives. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be. Following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.